This is London Calling.
I'm Graham Mack and welcome to the programme and part two of my chat with retired NASA astronaut Terry Virts, who had a lot to say about the direction that NASA's going in. In particular, a project called the Deep Space Gateway.
This proposal has come out in a time where we don't even have a NASA administrator. It kind of was during the in-between administration plan. So I don't know if it's actually going to happen or not.
But
I hope it doesn't, because if we end up pursuing it, it'll be several decades. And at the end of those several decades, we'll have another space station in orbit that just costs a lot more money and we spend less time at. And we won't have things like electric space propulsion that can help get us to Mars and back faster.
More from Terry Virts later. Well, I hope you had a nice Christmas, and I hope you got some nice presents. What's the worst present you ever got? Lynn?
I wanted a knitting machine.
Yes.
So Pete bought me one.
Mm-hmm.
And then he realised before Christmas he couldn't afford it. So he sent it back, but I had to wait for the delivery man to collect it.
Wait a second. So you had to collect it and then wrap it up and give it straight back?
Yeah, well, that's right. He got it, got it delivered, he wrapped it up, then realised he couldn't afford it, and...
Oh, then you had to wait for the delivery man to come and pick it up?
Yeah. Would you like... Actually, I'm in the car with Pete now. Would you like to speak to him? Here he is.
Yeah.
Hang
Pete.
On, Graham.
Pete, what were you thinking?
Hello. Well, I ordered it on the catalogue.
Yeah.
I wasn't earning a lot of money then.
Right.
I had to please the old girl.
Yes.
And then I had to, well, I ordered it, got it, wrapped it up, and I suddenly realised I couldn't afford the payments on it, so I got her to send it back.
Right, but it was all wrapped up now as a Christmas present.
I know, but I am thoughtful, in some ways.
Did you get her anything else instead, then?
No.
That was it? That was Christmas ruined because of you?
Well, it wasn't ruined in my...
I'm not sensing a lot of remorse here, Pete.
I did... treat her to something else. What was it I bought? I can't remember what I bought now. I did take her to France, I think.
Oh, well, that's nice. That's nice.
Yeah. So I did repent. And
right.
Because
the worst thing to get would be a pair of knitting needles, wouldn't it?
Well.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, Pete.
That's all right, mate.
Cheers.
Love talking to you.
And
bye.
You too. Britain's Brexit nightmare continues. The head of the European Council says the UK and the EU face a furious race against time to finalise Brexit talks before March 2019. Meanwhile, the British government has lost a vote in the House of Commons because Parliament want the right to vote on the final terms agreed for leaving the EU. The thing is, all of this and all of these talks with the heads of the European Union are meaningless. That's because at the end of the day, any one of the 27 member states can veto any part of any deal. The British government keep referring to the talks they're having with the EU as negotiations. Well, they're not. Because in any negotiation, the side that gets the best deal is the one with the best BATNA. That stands for Best Alternative to Negotiated Agreement. What it usually means is the option of walking away if you don't like the deal on offer. Britain has no BATNA. We're leaving the EU anyway. So we don't have any leverage. We can't walk away because that would mean staying in the EU. We can't do that because we had a referendum. So there's a mandate from the people for us to leave. We didn't vote to leave only if we get a good deal. We just voted to leave. So we're leaving whatever the deal is, no matter how crappy. With no BATNA, if we think we have any control over what's going on here, we're delusional. And it's time we realised that. The EU will decide what will happen and what it will cost. And then all 27 member states have to agree to that. And if we're not happy with the terms, well, that's irrelevant. Ultimately, we won't be happy. It has to be a bad deal for Britain, because the EU have to make leaving as painful as possible. They need to do that to send a clear message to other countries that might be thinking about seceding from the Union. With no BATNA, all Britain can do is plead with the EU not to make Brexit too excruciating. That's not negotiating. That's begging. Like all nightmares, this one will only end when we wake up. If you're a bloke, what have you done to impress a lady? Women on Reddit have been revealing some of the things that men have done in front of them. These include hunting a squirrel and reciting the periodic table. What have you done to impress a lady? Mick?
Yeah, there was quite a few of us. We all went out, and obviously there's a certain girl in the group you like, so he's trying to get close to her.
Yeah.
Decided to go out to one of these Japanese restaurants. So we all sat around and choosing stuff, and then they started choosing all this hot chili stuff, and I'm not allergic, but I'm not very keen on the hot stuff. So they started eating all this hot stuff.
You were doing this to impress this lady, yes.
And she started eating all this hot stuff, and I said to her, I don't really eat all that. And she goes, go on. She goes, you won't hurt. Just try. I said, just try something for me, she says. So I'm eating all this hot stuff, and it's making me feel really ill. And then about 15 minutes after I started eating it, I spent most of the night on the toilet. I couldn't do any more. That was it. I was gone. He's a good laugh, isn't he? And I'd spend most of the night on the toilet.
So, needless to say, you never got it together with this lady.
I didn't, because she walked off with one of my mates the same night.
All because he had a cast iron constitution.
Exactly that, yeah.
The US has blamed North Korea for the WannaCry computer virus. I blame Bill Gates. The White House Homeland Security Advisor, Tom Bossert, said North Korea was directly responsible for the WannaCry malware attack that hit hospitals, businesses, and banks across the world in 2017. The thing that's not widely reported after these attacks is that they only affect computers running Microsoft Windows operating system. Computers running other operating systems like Apple, Linux, and Google Chrome OS don't get hit by these global hacks. Clearly, the problem is with Microsoft's operating system. It's not fit for purpose. Bill Gates has become one of the richest people in the world, and he's done it by selling an inferior product. Microsoft Windows is a playground for cyber criminals. It repeatedly fails to keep its customers safe online. And Windows is such a flaky OS that you have to pay for other programs to reduce your chances of being hit. These antivirus programs make money for their creators in a business that's almost a protection racket. And if Norton and McAfee can make Windows safe, why can't Microsoft? If a car maker sold cars with locks that let bad guys in and lock their owners out, there'd be a recall of those cars, and people would be put off buying that brand. But Microsoft keep getting away with it. And Windows continues to be the world's most popular OS. Could that be because the news isn't reporting things properly? The media describes malware hacks as attacks on computers and talks about computer viruses, as if all computers are affected, instead of making it clear that it's only computers running dirty Windows. It's time for a class action lawsuit against Bill Gates and Microsoft. They should be forced to pay billions in compensation to companies and individuals that have been attacked because of their crappy Windows program. It should be curtains for Windows. Things blokes have done to impress ladies. And Jane's a bloke did something very special to impress you. What was it?
He took me to the Taj Mahal in India to propose.
Wow, well, that's how did that go down?
That was husband number two, and I said yes.
Right, so that one worked.
Well, it did for a while.
Yeah, what let it down?
He did.
Okay.
But, you know, it was a very nice gesture. And
what husband are you on now? I'm allowed to keep count here.
Number four.
Okay.
But I'm not having any more. It's the last one. It's the absolute last one. The older you get, Graham, your choices start to run out.
I see, right.
So, no, actually, this one's good.
Really good. I once heard a very cruel thing about blondes. Are you blonde, Jane?
No.
Okay, well then, that's fine.
I'm a redhead.
Right, you won't be offended by this joke. Very, very politically incorrect joke. What have blondes and cowpats got in common?
Go on.
The older they get, the easier they are to pick up.
You're dead right. That is so politically
incorrect.
Yes, it is. But very funny.
Yes, but it's out of my system now. I've said it.
You've said it.
So this fella, he took you to the Taj Mahal in India, Mystic East, and you swooned and it worked.
My mum and I had kind of worked out what he was going to do, so I'd bought an appropriate outfit and I was practicing my acceptance speech.
Oh, I see, right.
So
okay.
I kind of, because he's a bloke, you know, he was a bit predictable in detail.
Right.
But the thought was there.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It was a really lovely, lovely place to be
proposed
to.
Oh, I'm sure. Yes. If you're thinking of getting a dash cam fitted to your car, don't. Unless you enjoy spending ever-increasing amounts of money on software and SD cards and have hours of spare time to faff about with it, a dash cam is not for you. I thought I wanted one for Christmas. I was wrong. A few weeks before Christmas, I had one fitted to my car. Actually, I had two fitted, because the last accident I was involved in was a bloke who went into the back of me. Front and back cameras cost more. The price went up from just under £100 to around £200. Then I decided I wanted HD video so I could read the number plates of anyone who hit me. That cost even more. Then there was the cost of some power controller thing that makes sure the battery doesn't go flat while it records in parking mode. By the time I'd bought all of the hardware and had the thing fitted, I had a bill for just under £400. And that was just the beginning of my nightmare. The camera uses a tiny SD card, like the ones that go into your smartphone. Getting it out of the camera is beyond fiddly, especially when you're in the driver's seat and you're right-handed. The dash cam is attached high up on the windscreen on the left, so you've got nothing to lean on. First, you have to unplug the power lead, then the other lead that runs to the rear camera. Once you've done that, you can pop off a cap, and finally, with your little finger, push the end of the tiny SD card to make it pop out by about 2 millimeters, just enough for you to grip the edge of the card with your fingernail. The next thing you do is drop it and lose it somewhere in the car. Thankfully, because the card is out of the camera and the power's disconnected, you don't get to digitally capture audio of you swearing at yourself. The interior of my car's black, and so is the micro SD card. After moving the passenger seat backwards and forwards, I eventually found the micro SD card in one of the cup holders. I put the tiny SD card in the adapter that turns it into a full-size SD card. It's still not that much bigger than a postage stamp. I don't know why they had to miniaturize the thing even more. Maybe they just wanted to make it easier to lose. Anyway, I slotted it into the back of my iMac. Not long after that, I discovered that iMovie can't read AVI files, the ones that the dash cam records in. So I downloaded the viewer software from the dashcam manufacturer's site. I can't edit or save any of the files with it, but at least I can see and hear what it's captured. Now, I drive to Liverpool and back every Sunday to present a show on BBC Radio Merseyside. It's about a 400-mile round trip, which means I'm on the road for 8 hours on a Sunday. I discovered that the 16-gigabyte micro SD card that comes with the dash cam only has enough storage for about half an hour's worth of HD recording on the road. After that, it goes back and records over the stuff it recorded at the beginning. So all you get is the last half hour of your last journey. It did produce at least an hour's worth of high-quality footage of the brick wall that the car faces while parked at my block of flats overnight, though. That's a shame, because I get to Liverpool city centre before 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning. I was hoping to film some of the early morning sights, like the Shaun of the Dead zombie apocalypse that greets me on Hanover Street as drunks try to hail me thinking I'm an Uber, and the barefoot girls holding their shoes wearing tiny dresses, zigzagging on tiptoes and dodging pavement pizzas. 65 megabyte micro SD cards cost £25 from Wilko's. I need two, so that when I take one out of the camera, I can put a fresh one in. So another £50 spent there. After driving around for a few days with the new 65 gigabyte micro SD card in, I decided to take it out and see what was on it. Of course, I dropped it again, and after moving both seats this time, I found it on the ledge in front of the speedometer. I put the micro SD card in its adapter and slotted it into the iMac. This time, the computer couldn't even read the card. It turns out that it hadn't been formatted. Well, I know when I put it in the camera, a bossy female voice told me to wait while it was formatting, but she must have been lying. I found out that I could format it, though, through the viewer software that I'd downloaded, but that meant erasing everything. That didn't matter. I couldn't read what was on there anyway. After formatting and erasing, the computer now recognised the 65 gig micro SD card that I got from Wilko's. I went to the preferences section to set up how I wanted the camera to work. There's an option on there to stop it recording sound from inside the car and a few other tweaks I wanted to do. But a message came up saying there was no firmware on the card. I don't even know what that is. But I managed to download firmware for my model of dashcam from the manufacturer's site. But now I can't work out how to get the firmware onto the SD card. I tried drag and drop. That doesn't do it. So now I've gone back to the original 16 gigabyte micro SD card that came with the camera. I don't know if it's recording or not, and I'm scared to take it out in case I lose it. I've noticed the light doesn't come on anymore when I'm parked. So maybe it's not recording in parking mode anymore, and I'll get no more footage of that brick wall. Has that got something to do with me erasing and reformatting it? I don't know. To be honest, I've had enough of it now. I really wish I hadn't spent close to £450 on it so far. I could buy two 65-gigabyte micro SD cards from the manufacturer's site. The instruction book makes it very clear they don't recommend any other kind. The official ones, presumably, come complete with the correct firmware, but they cost £89 each. And I'll still need to buy some editing software that reads AVI files on a Mac if I want to keep any of the footage. That's going to be another £44. The irony is, the main reason I got a dash cam was in case I had an accident, like when that bloke went into the back of me. But now I feel like I've been rear-ended by the dash cam! Do you know what a listicle is? It's a cross between a list and an article. BuzzFeed has got loads of them. Here's some of the titles of listicles on BuzzFeed. 17 things guys need to leave in 2017. The 30 most important cats. Hair products that changed your life. Now, the British tabloids, they don't tend to do listicles. They go with your quick quiz instead, like, is your partner cheating? Take our test. Find the perfect chocolate to match your star sign. Which Downton Abbey character are you? I think, if BuzzFeed's lists are called listicles, then maybe tabloid tests should be called testicles. Which should fit, because they are a load of balls. Okay, let's check in with my guest. It's retired NASA astronaut Terry Virts. He's flown the shuttle and the International Space Station. I asked him, when he was on the ISS, what was the scariest moment?
We had an episode where the ammonia leak alarm went off. And the space station, there's different categories of alarms, cautions, warnings, emergencies. And there's three different types of emergencies that we train for. One of them is an air leak, which obviously is bad.
Yeah.
One of them is a fire. And then the third one is an ammonia leak. And fire false alarms happen fairly often. Some of the smoke detectors there are not the best. And, you know, I saw multiple fire alarms went off. Thankfully, they were all false. There's been a few leak false alarms over the years, but when I was there in the 15 years of the space station program, this had never happened. And we had the first ever ammonia leak, and it's really serious. In training, they tell us that if you smell ammonia, don't worry about it because you're going to die.
Wow.
Ammonias are very deadly. And the station uses it, the American half of the station uses it as a coolant fluid. So all this equipment and sunlight generates heat. And just like your car has radiator fluid, the space station has a cooling fluid. And ammonia works really, really well in the temperatures and pressure. It's a great fluid for transferring heat. It's just completely deadly. So when the alarm went off, Samantha and I were in our crew quarters. I was doing email. She was doing whatever. It was a work day. Just there we were minding our own business. We both popped our heads out of the crew quarters and looked at the panel. And I was like, is that a leak? Is that an air leak? And Samantha's like, no, that's ammonia. And so we put on our oxygen masks. We floated down to the Russian side of the station and we closed the hatch.
Yeah.
Because the Russians use ammonia. They use basically sugar water, glycol. And it's not as good of a coolant fluid, but it doesn't kill you. So again, differences in philosophy. And we spent the day there. The alarm actually happened twice. The first time they said false alarm, and then 20 minutes later they said, no, it's a real deal. So we went back to the Russian segment, and a gentleman by the name of Dmitry Rogozin, the Russian, he's the deputy prime minister. He's, you know, like the vice president there. He's a big official, had been tweeting, trash-talking America about sanctions. Apparently, Twitter and international leaders is a thing nowadays. So in the middle of all this terrible, you know, Russia-U.S. stuff, he's the guy that walked me out to my Soyuz. I'm carrying my cooling box in this uncomfortable spacesuit. He walked me out to the Soyuz. And then a couple months later, here we are in space with this ammonia leak. And he called us up and said, American colleagues, you can stay as long as you want. We're going to work together. And so during this serious emergency, with all this political tension on the ground, it was a great example of America and Russia working together, you know, to basically to stay alive in space.
Yeah.
It was a really poignant moment for me. But we spent the day thinking that the space station's going to die. Like we were staring at each other going, we're the last people to be on the American half of the space station. Because if there is ammonia there, you can never go back because it's a deadly fluid. I mean, you could go back wearing ammonia protective gear, but you're not ever going to be able to use it, you know, for more than a few minutes at a time. And then at the end of this day, going, the space station's done, Houston called up and said, just kidding, it was a false alarm. But when you go back, wear your oxygen masks and take some samples just in case. So when I went back into the American side, having abandoned it, it was so eerie. It was like some Star Trek movie of, you know, boarding this abandoned spaceship. There was things floating around that we had just left in a panic as we were going down the Russian side. It was really eerie. It was like a ghost ship. And it, in the long run, it ended up being a false alarm. The computer had had some radiation hits that had it give out some bad data, thankfully. But we really spent a day thinking it was a bad day in space.
You mentioned movies there. A lot of movies are set in space. And as a professional, you must just look at them and go, well, that wouldn't happen and that's not right. But which movie has got closest to giving people who've never been into space an idea of what space is like? I'm not talking about the IMAX movies that NASA make. I'm on about like the Hollywood movies. Which one is the closest to the real thing?
Yes, I'd say Beautiful Planet, since I filmed it.
Yes, I know you would.
But as far as like fictional movie, so Gravity, I'm friends with the cinematographer, a guy named Chivo Lebeski.
Yeah.
Well, he won the Emmy Award for Best Picture 3 years in a row, back to back to back. And Gravity was one of them. And visually, it's really good. It's an animated movie.
Yeah.
But they got the visuals of what the space shuttle looked like and what the space station looked like really good. Now, thankfully, there's not that total disaster explosion using a fire extinguisher to fly to the Chinese station. You know, they had to make it interesting to sell tickets.
Yeah.
But the visuals of Gravity were pretty good. A movie that gets the culture and spirit of spaceflight, I think, better than anyone is The Right Stuff.
Right.
Older movie, and it's about Chuck Yeager and the sound barrier and the early Mercury astronauts. I just love the cultural and the interpersonal and The Right Stuff. I mean, I love that part of that movie. Zambo and I watched it the night before our launch on the space shuttle. So,
tell me about life, adjusting to life on Earth after being in space. I mean, do you find yourself leaving things in midair and they just fall to the floor a lot?
I did. After my first shuttle flight, I landed. I was at the hotel. My parents were down there and I took a water bottle and just, I went to throw it to mom and it just dropped and hit the ground. So I did do that. But I was really a little bit concerned about it. I was afraid I'd be depressed, you know, postpartum depression. And so when I got back to Earth, you land, you take a helicopter to the airport, you take a business jet 24 hours across the planet to get back to Houston. It's a 24-hour trip from Kazakhstan to Houston. And while I was in space, my son had turned 16, and he got his driver's license. So 24 hours, I land in Houston, go to the gym for an hour and a half to work out. And then my son was like, all right, Dad, we're going car shopping. So he took me to the car dealership. And it was completely normal. And I can remember driving down Nassau Road 1 by the I-45, the highway, and seeing those red lights. And I just remember thinking, I'm back. Like, I'm on Earth. Everything's normal. I'm back to life. And it really surprised me how immediately that light switch had gone on to, I'm not in space anymore. I'm back on Earth. And it was a surprising but really good thing. I didn't really suffer. I think some guys kind of get the letdown, you know, post-spaceflight letdown.
I think Buzz Aldrin in his book talks about he went through a hard readjustment process.
And it's under, you know, if you win the Super Bowl, what do you do after that? Or if you're a Hollywood megastar and then you don't have anything after that, it can be really tough. And for me personally, I didn't want to be, you know, hanging on to that thing. I kind of wanted to move on to my next phase of life and before it got to be too late. So I wanted to write a book. I wanted to do speaking. I wanted to do a TV show. There's all these other things I want to do in life. So I just said, man, flying in space was awesome. I loved it. I met some great people at NASA and I had a great experience. And now it's time to move on to the next phase of life. So thankfully, I did not have to deal with that, but I know it is a struggle for some folks.
Let's talk about NASA. Why haven't we been back to the moon?
So can you imagine, when I was a kid, I never would have guessed we'd be celebrating the 50th anniversary still in low Earth orbit and not being back to the moon. Yeah. I mean, it's terrible. But after space flights, they sent us around and talked to congressmen and senators. And since I've left Air Force and NASA, I've had a chance to talk to a lot of folks in Washington about space policy. And the one point I always make is that it's not about the rocket science. It's about the political science. And the rocket science is hard, but the political science is harder. And what we have lacked is, for the last almost decade now, we haven't had a vision or a plan or a goal. Now, the space station is going great. The space station program, Kirk Sharman, the manager, they do a great job operating and flying people in space and doing science. There really is a lot of great stuff that NASA's doing with robotically, of course, but even with humans in space, that's going really well. But beyond the space station, we had a program called Constellation that was start building pieces and parts to go to the moon and then eventually on to Mars. That got canceled in 2009, and it was not really replaced with anything. So we've been spending all this time with a lot of words, but not without an actual plan. And so one of the things, I just wrote some articles, as you mentioned, about having a vision for the future of spaceflight. You need to know what your vision is. With Kennedy, it was really simple. Put a man on the moon and bring him back safely to Earth. By the way, that was my favorite part of his speech, return him safely to Earth.
Yeah, I bet, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. Yeah. But we had a vision. And then we had political support. And the plan didn't change every 4 years when a new administration came in. Richard Nixon was president when Buzz and Neil landed on the moon, not Kennedy and not Johnson.
Yeah.
And they actually put resources behind it. So while we have had a really good vision and a good plan in the past, we haven't necessarily had the dollars for it. And then that got canceled, and then we didn't have a vision or the dollars. And so that we kind of need to figure out a way to make space and NASA less political. It's not a Republican issue. It's not a Democrat issue. It's a human issue. And really, all Americans support space. People around the world support space. In the UK, actually, you guys are finally supporting human spaceflight with Tim Peake. And, for decades, Britain didn't support human spaceflight. And they supported the European Space Agency unmanned things, but not the human part.
Mm-hmm.
But, countries around the world, people around the world are very fascinated by space travel. There's a lot of support for doing things. We just need the leadership that will make it less of a political issue in America and put together a plan that can survive, over time.
And a long-term plan too, because, even Apollo, I think it was supposed to go to Apollo 20 and it was cut back to 17, but beyond that, there wasn't a plan. It wasn't like there was a long-term plan for the continued exploration of the moon and supplying the moon. I mean, I always wonder I don't know much about space flight or orbital mechanics, only what I've read. And there's that thing called the free return trajectory, where it's possible to put something in a looping orbit between the Earth and the Moon. I always wonder why they didn't get a vehicle doing that, and then they just needed one to launch from Earth up to that, and then one from the vehicle down to the surface. And I know Buzz Aldrin has proposed a similar system for Mars. Do you think they should have really worked on that earlier?
Well, I agree with that plan. I think for Mars, you need Buzz calls it a cycler. He has a cycling pathway. Mars is his vision. And I think that's an important part of it, because you can take like the habitat or the transfer module. You don't need, every time you take you take British Airways from London to New York, Boeing doesn't build you a new 787, right?
Yeah.
So the same way, why spend a few billion dollars on a new spaceship if you can figure out a way to launch people from Earth, get on that transfer vehicle, go to Mars, and then I think that's an important way to do it. I agree.
Yeah. Now, NASA has announced plans for this new space station orbit in the moon called the Deep Space Gateway. And I read an article. You've had a lot to say about this. You don't think it's necessarily a great idea. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, I know the folks that came up with that are some of the smartest rocket scientists, and they're really great people. And I've sat in the room with the chalkboard full of this drawn up in different orbits and stuff. The problem with it is the goal of Deep Space Gateway is to find a reason and a job for the SLS rocket and the Orion capsule. It's not we want to go to Moon or we want to go to Mars and this is what we need to do to get there. It's the self-licking ice cream cone. It's, well, we have these things, now what do we do with it? And NASA was charged with finding out something to do with these vehicles that we have. And that's just, we're putting the chicken before the egg. And what we need is to go, we need to go to Mars. So Apollo, the moon program was not Apollo. It was Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo.
Yeah.
Mercury was, can we even fly people in space? Gemini was the most important part of it. It was testing and developing the technologies that you needed for Apollo, like rendezvous, spacewalking, multiple crew members, long duration missions. All the stuff you needed for Apollo was tested in Gemini.
Yeah.
And then we finally got to Apollo. So what we need to do now is figure out, do we want to go to Mars? If we do, what's the Gemini that we need? What are the technologies that we need to get to Mars? And the Deep Space Gateway doesn't provide anything that we need for anywhere. It's basically building a space station piece by piece in orbit around the moon is what Deep Space Gateway is. And we already know how to build a space station. I actually finished building the space station. Yeah. So we know how to build modules and assemble them in orbit. The difference is if you put it in orbit around the moon, it's a lot farther away and you have to add a zero on your launch costs. It's really expensive to get stuff way out there. And it's really dangerous because the radiation environment is really terrible in orbit around the moon. And if astronauts are going to be doing science, it's going to be a much smaller space station. There's going to be much less crew time because you can only spend weeks there rather than months like you can on the space station because of radiation. And so at the end of the Deep Space Gateway program, we don't have anything that benefits us in any way. We already know how to build a space station. And if you want to go to the moon, you're better off going to the moon rather than going to this orbital space station, which costs you time and money and propellant to get there. And then it costs propellant to get down to the moon. So I just don't see any benefit for it. And I know the reason we're doing it is just to find something for Boeing and, or not, I don't want to pick on Boeing, but to find something for the, these programs in congressional districts to have a reason for being. And it does not actually lead to important goals, I think, like going to Mars.
Is it just a job creation program then for the contractors in the congressman's areas, you know?
It is. But ironically, if we actually had a Mars program, those same districts and that same SLS heavy lift rocket would have lots of work to do too. It would just be meaningful work that actually led to a Gemini program of testing and developing technologies that would be useful for the future. So it's not a question of, if we don't have Deep Space Gateway, everybody gets laid off. There is useful work to be done, but if you're going to land on the moon, it costs more money than just building an orbital space station. So this proposal has come out in a time where we don't even have a NASA administrator. It kind of was during the in-between administration plan. So I don't know if it's actually going to happen or not.
Yeah.
But I hope it doesn't, because if we end up pursuing it, it'll be several decades. And at the end of those several decades, we'll have another space station in orbit that just costs a lot more money and we spend less time at. And we won't have things like electric space propulsion that can help get us to Mars and back faster. We won't have things like landers and how to build landers together, because, you know, a Mars lander or a moon base would probably need multiple modules on the surface. And we've never put two things together on the surface of another planet. That would be a great technology to test out. A lot of the stuff we need for actually going places, there's no there where Deep Space Gateway is going.
Yeah.
It's a high altitude, was it a rectilinear orbit? HALO is the acronym for it, in cislunar space. And so if you're going to, whenever you hear the term cislunar space, that's like a fancy term for there's nothing there.
Right. So would, as far as getting to Mars goes, would Elon Musk and his SpaceX project, would that be a better bet?
Well, the thing about Elon is he's building rockets, and he says he's going to build, and I think he will, a heavy lift rocket. It won't be as big as SLS, and really, bigger is better, because if you have smaller rockets, you end up needing to build things in space, and it's more efficient just to have one thing and launch it on one launch. But, you know, if he can provide the heavy lift rockets, that'll go a long way towards getting people to Mars. One of the most important technologies for Mars, I think, is a faster way to get there. And there's a thing called electric propulsion. What we do now is chemical propulsion. You burn an oxidizer and a fuel. You burn that just like combustion on Earth, and that makes you go a certain velocity. Electric propulsion is you use electricity to shoot out a lightweight gas at really, really, really much higher speeds. The exhaust goes away from the rocket at very high speeds, which means the rocket ends up going a lot faster than a chemical rocket can go. And you can get to Mars and back in about a year using electric propulsion, whereas a chemical rocket mission takes about 3 years.
Wow.
And so that extra 2 years, that's a lot of underwear you have to pack for those 2 years.
And can you generate the electricity in space as well?
So you hit on the most important part. You can if you build a nuclear reactor.
Right.
NASA has lots of electric propulsion satellites that we're flying right now. We have them in orbit, but they use kilowatts of power with solar panels because they're really small. And you can do that with kilowatts. But with humans, you need megawatts. So you need an actual nuclear reactor, which can be done. The Russians have flown nuclear reactors in space back in the 60s. But that requires a political will that I don't think America has. I think we have such a short attention span and we have so many special interests. But there are other countries in the world that don't have the political sausage factory that is Washington, right? So if you made an international partnership, that would be a great program for another country, would be to bring the nuclear power plant. You know, America could bring the lander, the Europeans could build the habitat module, and another country might be able to bring a nuclear power plant. And when you put all those things together, you can get to Mars and back in a year. If you do the chemical thing, my friends at NASA that know what they're talking about and studied it have said 7 to 9 SLS launches to build the Mars ship, which is insane. The launch rate for SLS is going to be 1 a year. Like, you might be able to push it up to 2 a year.
Yeah.
But in other words, it's going to take years and years just to build one Mars ship in Earth orbit to get it ready to go to Mars on this 3-year journey. And the cost for that is prohibitive. The length of time is prohibitive. And I just don't think you can do that. Plus, the poor crew is going to be floating in space for probably a year and a half,
yeah,
getting irradiated. And it's just not a good, that's not the way to get to Mars. I think you get there and back as fast as you can.
Tell me about the book, Terry Virts, View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World.
I am super excited about this book. It's a space mission in book format. And so I tried to use photographs. I ended up taking the most photographs ever on my mission. It was 319 plus thousand pictures.
Which is more photographs than anyone's taken from space, isn't it?
That's what the NASA people said, that they were so happy when I landed because they didn't have to downlink so many pictures and catalog them. It's a National Geographic book, so the photography aspect is really important. There's a lot of beautiful images in there. But it's also full of stories. I wrote the book myself, which I really wanted to write it myself without a co-author. And that was something I was a little nervous about, being a math major. My high school English teachers would have been surprised, to say the least, that I wrote a book. But I just really enjoy the process of writing. What this book is not is a memoir. There's been a million memoirs out there. That story has been told. And I didn't want to write a book that's already been written. It's also not a photography atlas of the Earth. It's not, you know, a reference book. It's what I try to do is combine beautiful and interesting pictures and stories from the space mission so that you get a sense of what it's like to fly in space.
Is the photo of you giving the Vulcan hand signal in there?
So we had a chapter 7 is about spacewalking. I did 3 spacewalks in a week, and the day before the final one, so it's been a killer week. We've been working nonstop. I got an email from a friend of mine at NASA that said Leonard Nimoy had passed away. So Mr. Spock died, and can you do something? And I didn't know what to do. I had a spacewalk tomorrow. I didn't have time. So I ran down to the cupola, which is the 7-windowed observing module, and I did the Vulcan Live Long and Prosper salute, and I just took a picture of it, and I was worried about my hand. I had to get the writing light. Didn't want to show all my wrinkles. And, you know, I was like trying to get the Vulcan salute framed. I took the picture and I tweeted it, and it got tens of millions of views. That's the PAO folks came. It was like the most popular tweet ever, and tens of thousands of likes within an hour or something. And it was just a great tribute. People around the world love Spock. I love Spock. It was a really cool tribute. What I didn't know, if you look at the image, and it is in the book, in the background is Long Island and Cape Cod and the East Coast of the U.S. And Boston is right in the center of this picture. And that was his hometown.
Wow.
I had no idea. I was worried about the lighting and where's the sun and getting my hand exposed. And I just happened to have his hometown in the background. And that was, in the F-16, we had a saying, I'd rather be lucky than good. This was an example of, you know, divine intervention, or I don't know what it was, but I was definitely more luck than being good, because it was not planned. But I was really, really excited and happy that, you know, it was like a little, just a bonus tribute for Leonard Nimoy.
That is just brilliant. So the book is out now. It is Terry Virts, View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. Thank you so much for your time today talking to me, Colonel. I've really, really enjoyed our chat. I'm a bit of a fan of space, and I've never spoken to an astronaut before, so it's a real thrill for me. It really is.
Well, it's been wonderful chatting with you, and hopefully I'll be at the UK for a few days. I'm hoping to stop by on my way to Antarctica, but I'll be doing hopefully some media there and maybe a book signing and enjoying some British weather.
Fantastic. Well, I hope I can get my book signed.
We'll have to make that happen.
Okay. Commander Terry Virts, thank you so much for your time. Live long and prosper.
And live long and prosper. Cheers.
Retired NASA astronaut Terry Virts. Hey, got some good guests coming up on future episodes of London Calling. You'll hear from the British satirist who's based in America, Tony Hendra. You might know him because he played the manager in This Is Spinal Tap. And as well as that, another guest coming up, international singing superstar Engelbert Humperdinck. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back. I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.